From KLCC Media, this is the Oregon Grapevine. I'm Barbara Dellenbach. The Oregon Grapevine highlights fresh-pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live. Dr. Phil Fisher is the director of the Center for Translational Neuroscience at the University of Oregon, the Philip H. Knight Chair and Professor of Psychology, and is running an ongoing nationally representative survey on the effect of the pandemic on families with young children. Thank you so much, Phil, for being here on Oregon Grapevine. I appreciate your time.
Oh, hi, Barbara, and thanks for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here.
You are running this study, but before you weren't. One day there wasn't a pandemic, and then the next day there was. So I'm wondering, what was the light bulb moment that kind of got you going on this piece of research?
I can think back to just over a year ago right now. I was actually over in the Bend area with my wife and some family friends, and we were talking about and wondering about what was going to be happening with the pandemic that was on everybody's mind, but, you know, sort of talking about it in pretty abstract terms. And by the time we were headed back from that weekend away, things had just in sort of domino order begun to shut down. So, you know, the schools were shutting and the NBA was shutting down, the border to Canada was shutting down. And so it became clear that it wasn't going to be a business as usual for quite some time. And with the friends that we were with, one of whom is a fellow colleague in the psychology department, we were talking about, well, what can we do? What do we have to offer that can make a difference at this time? What are the tools and knowledge that we have? Because we knew that we were headed into kind of terra incognita and needed to be as helpful as possible with the tools that we can bring to bear as psychologists. And my work has historically been on how children who experience adversity in their lives can still experience positive outcomes. We do a lot of work on brain development and try to understand how to support children's healthy development in spite of adversity. And a lot of that work has been done either in the laboratory or in the context of programs that we put in place to try to improve well-being. But we've never sort of seen ourselves as documenters of particular experiences that are unfolding historically. And so that's where we knew we had to go, was to put our tools that we had been using for other things to use to really tell the story of what households with young children were going through during this time.
So my non-scientifically educated life has me thinking that the scientific studies take a long time to set up and they're kind of complicated, and then you have to figure out funding, and you can't just say, this is what I want to do and do it. What happened here?
That's absolutely correct. Well, you know, it's sort of a silver lining story, Barbara. I mean, in a sense, you know, we benefited from the fact that suddenly everything, including our own laboratory in the University of Oregon, was idle. Things shut down. And so the projects that we had ongoing and the staff that we had that were used to delivering programs and supporting families or collecting data, doing brain imaging studies, those kinds of things, those folks were idle. And the other thing that was clear was that our funders, we do a lot of work through federal research funding, which certainly can take a really long time to turn around. But we have had very strong relationships and benefited from relationships with some large philanthropic foundations as well. And they saw the need and kind of agreed with us that we needed to do something. And I will tell you, like, the project got off the ground in truly lightning speed, and it's a credit to our staff and our funders that we were able to do that. It was really, about a month's time between when that early conversation happened over in the Bend area and when the first survey that we ran was collected, April 6th. And so things got off the ground very quickly. And I would say that probably we would not, even under those circumstances, have rushed the way that we did to get the survey into the field, except that if you remember back to those days, there were huge unknowns and everything was changing from one day to the next. And we knew that if we wanted to truly be able to capture the experiences of households with no children, that every day that passed, we were potentially missing something really vital. And so that really pushed us and motivated us to get the survey fielded as quickly as we could.
So you create a survey. Let's start with the kind of logistics of the survey. I'm interested in the questions that you ask, and then we can move to whom you are asking them. So what happens? I pick up the phone, and what are you asking?
Well, so for first, let me tell you that we knew that to get the survey out and get high-quality data, that we needed to administer it in a way that would not take a legion of staff. I mean, we have a good team here, but it's a small crew for fielding a national survey. And so we decided that the survey would be administered online. And by that, we mean that if anybody that had any kind of internet access, including internet access through cell service on your smartphone, could take the survey. We knew in terms of the content of the survey as it launched, that what we needed to do was sort of get a picture of the whole family and the whole household and what the kinds of things were going on. And as I said, we understand a lot about child development and parent-child relationships. So that part of the survey we knew for sure. We knew it to include questions about how parents were doing, how children were doing in terms of emotional well-being. But we also had to then start partnering with a large number of organizations that do advocacy, that are involved in policy work and so forth, to figure out what the additional areas that we wanted to cover were. And those areas included healthcare utilization, childcare, what people were doing given the sudden closure of all of these educational systems, preschool, childcare, and for slightly older kids, the kindergarten system. The other thing that was very clear was that we needed to capture the economic circumstances of families. And so we started to ask questions, not just about income, but very quickly learned that a much more comprehensive picture of economic well-being was really important, and that really the way that people tend to think about that has to do with more overall kind of material well-being. That is, do you have enough money to pay for food? Do you have enough money to pay the rent or pay your mortgage? Do you have enough money for utilities and other kind of basic necessities? And so we included a number of questions about material hardship and material well-being.
So you aren't, or people who are conducting the survey are not having necessarily emotionally riddled or ridden conversations with people. It's not a one-on-one conversation. It's all done online, and therefore, I don't mean to use sterile in an emotional sense, but maybe not hearing the sob stories or the difficult stories, and maybe that's a good thing. Maybe it takes away that piece.
So interesting that you would say that, Barbara. You know, I think sort of the necessity of gathering a large quantity of data made it difficult to have the level of contact that you maybe were anticipating. But we made a decision pretty early on that I think has been tremendously impactful because we knew that we were going to be collecting data online via something called a Qualtrics survey. So it's kind of like an online questionnaire that you can, push the responses to in terms of like on a scale of 1 to 5, how much loneliness were you feeling this week might be an example of a question. That quantitative information is really useful because you can say, 80% of our families are reporting that they're experiencing, a high level of loneliness or something like that. But what we realized early on was that we did really want to hear the actual voices, that we didn't just want numbers. And so we included open-ended questions. We started to include questions like, what are the biggest challenges that you're facing? What things are helping you the most right now in your lives? What would you like your elected officials or Congress people to know? And, they were just blank spaces into which people could type stuff. We have been really blown away by the content of the open-ended responses and by the frequency with which people put in open-ended responses. So to date, the survey's been up and running now for just over a year, and we've had over 120,000 people contribute responses in their own words about what they're going through. And I can tell you, having read many, many thousands of those comments, that, you know, the stories are at times devastating and at times inspiring. But truly, where we thought we would be documenting in order largely to influence policy, I think that continues to be sort of our primary goal. But I think we realized early on and have continued to feel like we were also bearing witness to what people were going through in a very compelling and necessary way.
Do you all as a research team get to debrief some of it? I would think some of the stories are difficult. Some of the stories might not be. I would think it could be hard, especially as psychologists, to kind of face it. Do you all have group meetings? How do you, before we go into like what you're going to do with the information, what do you do with it personally as researchers?
It's interesting. I mean, I have, a lot of the work that we did historically has focused on things like children who are and families who are connected to the child welfare system. And so a lot of our background is in understanding adversity and trauma and in developing ways to help support families and individuals who've experienced trauma, who've experienced early childhood neglect and so forth. So I think the idea that this project would be uncovering some truly sort of fundamental challenges that families are going through in some ways didn't come as a surprise, but the quantity of information that we've been gathering, because the survey, every time it goes out, we hear from just over 1,000 households, has been really quite impactful. And our team is a very tight-knit team. I think we were sort of forged in fire in the context of this this particular project. And I do think it's sort of helped us, because it's such a close-knit team, to be able to contain really some of the intensity of what we're hearing. And at times, I think it's really remarkable to see how much families have been able to withstand. You know, people have said parents, and in particular moms, are kind of the unsung heroes of the pandemic. And it's clear how much weight people are bearing and bearing it well. I think if anything, we've taken some degree of comfort in the fact that by telling people we wanted to hear their voices and by providing a place where they can, that maybe at least for some, that we've allowed them to unburden themselves and let somebody else know what they were going through. And I think that feels in and of itself like a major contribution of the survey.
What do you do with all this information?
Yes, it's a lot of information. It comes in, and for the first few months, we were doing the survey on a weekly basis. At the end of July, we shifted it to every other week, and we have continued to collect the data on an every other week basis since then. We do a number of different things with the data. As I said, one of the primary goals from the get-go was to try to influence policy. But in the early days of the survey, it was sort of, I felt like we were learning things that just weren't on people's radar. Like there was a lot of information out there about schools closing, and there was a lot of information out there about uncertainty about people getting sick. But there was not a lot of information specifically about the challenges that households with young kids were going through. And yet, you know, I'm sure you experienced this too, and many listeners did, like whether it is in your own personal life or just in your immediate surroundings, so many people we knew suddenly were, you know, trying to figure out how to work, whether from home or in jobs that were at that point essential jobs but felt unsafe, while balancing having kids at home and, you know, juggling all of these things. And so the initial sort of few months of the survey was it almost felt like we were just since I'm on KLCC, like a very low frequency, low power radio station trying to transmit information so that people could hear what was going on. And fortunately, I think there was a lot of interest. The media was really hungry for the data that we were collecting. And so we started to garner a pretty large amount of media coverage, not just local, but also national media coverage that, allowed, we were basically a source for reporters to say, okay, 60% of households with young children right now who are Black and Latinx have, are reporting that they are having a difficulty at least with one area of basic needs, whether it's rent or food or utilities. And that kind of data was unique. And so in the initial phase of the survey, that's mostly what we were doing, was just sort of like, waving a flag and saying, come listen to us because we have data that can really be used to influence outcomes. Since then, we sort of shifted away from just trying to get stories out in the media and are really now much more targeted at public policy, at elected officials, at officials in governmental, governor's offices and so forth, to share this information with them. And that's become especially true as we pivoted to the new administration, where, we're no longer just trying to say, like, things are terrible and please pay attention to what's going on with families, but where now things are going to be changing in terms of financial resources becoming available. And so we're working with advocacy organizations. We're working with policymakers. We do a ton of webinars and lots of other ways to disseminate the data that we're getting into the hands of people who need it to be able to say, okay, what kinds of policies should we pass to support households with young children? And are those policies working? Since our survey is so frequent, we're able to have the potential to see whether we can see any improvements in well-being as a result of these measures that are now beginning to appear on the horizon.
Not to throw too much cynicism in here, but it seems to me that it can be somewhat glacial to get policies, first of all, written, and second of all, implemented, and then thirdly, followed. So do you see that actually in this time that not just organizations are getting information, and that's interesting, but do you see that governments and systems and organizations are actually doing something to help these people?
Yeah, I think your, sort of uncertainty is well placed. My friends who are economists say policy is a blunt instrument, and it's not necessarily going to be able to target precise issues like, families in one area that have a particular gap or need. And at the same time, some of the things that, we would describe as policies are, it is possible to detect some of the effects. So I'll just give you a concrete example. If you think back to last spring and summer, the CARES Act was in place. It was the provision by the federal government to make sure that there was ongoing pandemic unemployment for people who had lost their jobs. And we were following families, during that time. And through July, the percentage of households in our survey, which is from all 50 states, so we get families from all around the country at all income levels and, across different racial and ethnic groups, the proportion of families that was putting at least one area in which they were having difficulty making ends meet with food, with shelter, with utilities and so forth, was 20%. The CARES Act ended at the end of July, and since that time, the proportion of families in our survey that say that they were having difficulty jumped up to 40% and has remained at 40%. So that was a policy that was in place that was helping, that when taken away, really pushed a bunch of people into much more difficult financial circumstances. And our data show, and this was not much of a surprise, but show what we've referred to as a chain reaction of hardship. That is, in a given week, if a family reports that they're having difficulty making ends meet, when we subsequently follow up with them, the parents report higher levels of emotional distress. And then when we look at those reports of parental emotional distress and we follow those families out in time, we see a significant association between parental distress and subsequently children experiencing emotional distress. So that whole chain reaction of hardship ultimately lands in the lap of the child. And all of our research and research of many other colleagues on early stress suggests that children experiencing kind of chronic distress in the context of adults who are dealing with their own challenges really sets kids up for this idea of toxic stress, where we begin to see impacts on brain and biology that are, you know, are not impossible to reverse, but that can have long-term effects across the span of development. So that's an example of a policy that was helping and went away. Now we're talking about policies that could be completely transformative, like the child tax credit and other aspects of the American Rescue Plan, that when they come into place can, you know, could fundamentally remove or at least lift a large portion of children in the U.S. out of poverty in terms of not being below the federal poverty lines anymore. And I don't think that's going to be the answer for everybody, but it's a starting point that will really potentially begin to make change. So yes, I think your cynicism is well placed, and I hope that it's counterbalanced at least a little bit with a little bit of optimism in terms of the policies that we're seeing right now coming through.
Always have to temper my cynicism with optimism. Thank you for that.
Don't we all?
Are there any takeaways from this survey that either you have really felt or that we should know kind of as we go? And do you see an end in sight to your weekly or biweekly conversations?
Yeah, great questions. So there are several takeaways from the survey, and I've kind of alluded to some of them. The first one is that from early on in the survey, we identified this chain reaction of hardship, this idea that at the root of what a lot of families were and have continued to be dealing with during the pandemic stems from basic inability to pay for, to cover the needs of the households financially. And I think we were really blown away by the incredibly high proportion of households that were reporting this. I mean, 40% of households saying that there's at least one area of in which they can't pay for basic needs is a very large number. When you think about that, it translates into millions and millions of families across this country. And it's not just, you know, like families that you might, or that your listening audience might think, oh, well, you know, families that have really been marginal for a long time. This is a lot of families that were, you know, far above the poverty guidelines for set for poverty for household size. That have struggled to make ends meet and are not even in a position to have enough food to feed their children. So clearly that's like one really big takeaway. A second is that the inequalities that existed long before the pandemic based on race and ethnicity, based on family structure and other kinds of things have just been sort of pushed wide open during the pandemic. So as I said, 40% of all households after August have experienced at least one material hardship, 60% of Black households, 60% of Latinx households, 60% of single-parent households in our survey have reported that they are having difficulty making ends meet. And that includes, in the Black and Latinx households, a large portion of households that were middle and upper income before the pandemic and have lost their grasp on prosperity. So I think those are two really big takeaways. Households with special needs kids have struggled mightily in terms of being able to access services, services being delivered online and via Zoom, clearly not a great fit for that sector of the population. I know agencies in this town like EC Cares have done an amazing job kind of filling the gaps that exist. But still, it's a really big challenge to for families with a child with special needs to get the services that were traditionally delivered in person and in educational settings to them. The other thing that has been the biggest takeaway for me and a real sort of learning experience is that The well-being of families is just inextricably tied to the well-being and the sort of the health of the childcare and early childhood education system. And by that, I don't just mean licensed, center-based preschools. I'm talking about the entire kind of crazy quilt of care that's provided in this country, often by women, in many instances by lower-income women of color, who take care of other people's kids, sometimes licensed, sometimes unlicensed, sometimes in formal arrangements, sometimes not in formal arrangements, but that really are the glue that holds the fabric of this country together in terms of people being able to work and children being cared for and being put on a trajectory to healthy education. And so really we come away and our plans for moving forward actually just launched a national survey of providers to go along with the national survey of families. And we're just planning to really continue to track as the Biden policies come into place, how well the childcare sector and how well households with young children are being supported and what additional needs there might be. The plans right now are to continue the survey at least through 2021. It's sort of shifting from a pandemic-focused survey to a post-pandemic kind of recovery survey to get a sense of how things will change as now these policies come into place. So hopefully it will continue, and always happy to, share our latest findings at any point.
Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I know, I think, a little more than I knew. So thank you for that.
Great. I appreciate it, Barbara.
You've been listening to KLCC Media's The Oregon Grapevine, fresh pressed conversations with people who are actively and passionately creating the present and future in which they wish to live.